This podcast is part of the Gonna Geek Network. The opinion expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gonna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GonnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, the podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio, now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry, we'll warn you again. Welcome to episode 86 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we take the time to contemplate what we would have been, could have been, nearly was, actually was, and might still be, all while saving the universe in 100 different ways from the relentless evil determination of the Daleks, while the vast majority of the universe remains blissfully unaware, all in today's work. I am Jay, and with me this week in the GPR studios is Keir. How's it going, Keir?
Very good, sir. Yourself?
I'm doing fantastic. And our newest official inductee into the GPR cast is Haley Malley. How's it going, Haley? Sorry.
Great.
We got her a name tag and everything.
I've been through this. I have a niece named Hallie. It throws me off. Anyway.
The almost rhyming first and last name don't help.
Yeah, that really doesn't. Anyway. So this week we have an opportunity to immerse ourselves in the work of the Eighth Doctor, as portrayed by Paul McGann. Though television viewers had only one chance to see McGann's turn at the TARDIS in the 1996 movie and attempted U.S. pilot, thank God it failed.
Unconfirmed pilot, but yes.
Yeah. But McGann has remained really active in the Whovian community, doing a lot of audiobooks, recording for some Big Finish Studios stuff, and also starring in a bunch of books, which I guess he's not really part of that, but still.
No, but I mean, he established the persona that the writers run with, so I consider that a testament to what he,
yeah,
you know, what I mean,
it's still his character, yeah, absolutely. So, yeah. And then, you know, obviously, what everyone really remembers recently is his appearance in the prequel or the webisode prequeling the timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly, the Night of the Doctor, the webisode that we all loved and glommed onto for days leading into the 50th.
Yeah, that was definitely one of the internet explosion moments when he appeared in his ratty frock coat and such.
And I mean, looked absolutely fantastic. I loved everything about that webisode. It was great. Mm. Yeah, so tonight we're going to be obviously looking into the Doctor Who movie from 1996. We're also going to be looking into a couple of the Big Finish audio dramas and, as we said, The Night of the Doctor. So got some stuff to dig into here.
Yeah. Well, all right. We're going to put a big coat on the hate hook and close that into the closet for a little while we talk about the movie. You know, just because let's, you know, say what you will about the script, say what you will about however it was executed, how it was aired, all those things. We're looking at this specifically from Mr. McGann's performance and what he did with the role given, you know,
right,
handed with what he was. So let's take a look at that.
Yeah, so this movie aired in May of 96 on Fox, which, I mean, there's your problem.
problem number one.
We got all these great notes from the studio.
It's amazing that we actually got this movie from, you know, before we got Night of the Doctor showing on Fox. It's just, you know, well done for them. Fox airing stuff in the wrong order. That never gets old. But this was actually up against ABC's strongest sitcom at the moment, which was Roseanne.
Yeah, which was killing at the time.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you've got an obscure British sci-fi show being brought in movie form onto a network that in 96 was still forming itself, really.
It was The Simpsons and some other stuff.
Cops.
Yeah, exactly. Cops.
Cops.
Yeah. So, you know, this really did not have a strong chance from the get-go.
But, all right, all that being said, and knowing the fact that you're bringing this to a U.S. audience, Haley, was this your first time watching this all the way through?
Yes, and hopefully last.
Okay. Well, fair.
No hate. No fair. Hate. We said no hate.
I will probably actually watch it one more time when I finally get there with my major rewatch, but I'm hoping you guys never make me watch this again.
Okay. No, that absolutely legit.
Next time we'll introduce the drinking game. It'll be a lot more fun.
Yeah. But when you, knowing what you know about the entire, the Whovian backstory, and if you were to come at this completely uninitiated and just say, oh, there's this, they're running this new show or this new movie, I'm going to check it out. And if you could possibly put yourself in the shoes of someone who did not know any Whovian lore, would this have made any sense to you?
I'm not sure it made any sense anyways, but yeah, if you were coming at this cold, well, I can't imagine getting your head around it.
Okay. Yeah, they force a lot of exposition in the first 15, 20 minutes or so to try and slam people into an understanding of how, Time Lord regeneration works, or the fact that the Master is a Time Lord, but he's already spent all his regenerations and now he's some kind of a smoky snake thing and on and on and on.
Yeah. I was going to say, I run a Doctor Who podcast and I'm not sure that I caught everything that I was supposed to. Yeah. It's a little bit muddled.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we have to kind of make a decision. Every Whovian has to make a decision for themselves as to whether or not you're really going to recognize a vast majority of this program. I'm not really sure if I want to call it a movie, being a made-for-TV movie, call it a broadcast, was actually canon, because so many adjustments were made to try and accommodate the shift of audience.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, where do you draw that line? The Doctor being half human on his mother's side.
I honestly, the whole way I hand wave it every time I watch it, and it's, I mean, I've, granted, it's been like all of like three times, but every time something comes up, I'm like, nope. See, he couldn't even remember who he was for like the first 20 minutes. It just, he's confused. He doesn't know what he's saying. But so somebody else is, that's not true.
Mm-hmm. And obviously the beginning of what became a long series of near romantic relationships with companions. This was the beginning of the slide.
Yeah.
That was just weird.
I don't think it would have been weird if it was just one. You know, he was dazed and confused, a bit loopy from the regen, really happy about his shoes. Just remember the name of his home planet. He's really he's elated, He's just having a great time, and there's this woman standing in front of him, and okay, big happy kiss. There you go.
Yeah, why not?
One.
Well, see, that's the thing. That was the one that started it all. He's like, "Holy crap, this is what I've been missing the whole time. I've got to get in on this. This has got to happen more often now." Yeah.
But as far as positives, I mean, as far as what McGann was doing with this thing coming into it, I mean, McCoy was in there for his to be able to see Seventh out, you know, and which may have obviously, talk about another thing which would have thrown uninitiated viewers. That could have been, probably was confusing as hell.
Yeah.
But, and did you get the impression that McCoy just didn't really want to be there?
Yeah, he definitely seemed very, unenthused. It's very much very like reminiscent of how Colin Baker didn't want to come back and do his regeneration, so he just didn't. But McCoy's like, no, I'm not gonna be that cold, but I'm not gonna enjoy it. Damn it.
But now from the moment he our eighth busts out of the morgue cooler, and we start to try and get a feel for this new persona, what's our knee jerk reactions in terms of what he ends up putting into the earliest stages of the role, the first lines we get from him, the first way he starts to carry himself as he's running around in his bedsheet toga?
My main thing is, why the hell is there an entire floor of a hospital completely open to the elements?
I didn't get the wing that was in a state of destruction. I didn't know if something had happened in a previous scene that I missed. They just blew the side off of it, because there was equipment all over the place.
Yeah.
This is obviously the worst hospital ever. They don't have scrubs for the doctors to change into. They don't rerun x-rays that they think are messed up, and they don't look at the x-rays before surgery.
It's a fancy hospital. It's like you have to be in like full ball gown in order to do surgery. They're just that upscale.
And mirrors and mirrors and mirrors and mirrors and mirrors. But all right. Well, we said we were going to put the things on the hate hook. Okay, let me get a second hate hook installed, and we'll do this too.
We might need like up to four because there's a lot to go with here.
All right. But I remarked on the fact that the way he was handling the reaction to the regeneration in terms of his emotional waves, in terms of his coming to terms with the change of physical form, the loopiness factor, it seemed like he was pulling a lot of elements from regenerations that we had seen to date. Some of them more stable, some of them more unstable, but he had little hints of a lot of those, which kind of, I don't know, it kind of told me that we were dealing with at least your lead actor, who seemed to know more about what the role was about than perhaps even the writers.
Is this the most confused region we've seen?
I think Fifth might have been.
Well, okay. I don't know. Fifth knew who he was. Like, he was definitely spacey, but he had moments of lucidity where Eighth was just completely like, I have no fracking idea what's going on.
True. Yeah. In terms of total loss of short-term memory and even those things, I mean, perhaps. Mm-hmm. I think, though, I didn't know. I saw that as we were going through, and maybe we're not going to be terribly concerned about spoilers or anything, because maybe some people will just choose that they're just not going to watch this for whatever reason. They say, oh, you know, there were too many confusing elements, or oh, it wasn't canon enough. I'm gonna understand the premise of what happened and never actually see it. It was interesting to see some of the things that they did spend a particular amount of time emphasizing, and that's things like the cloister room and the Eye of Harmony,
mm-hmm.
which had never really been addressed as that possibly being in the TARDIS before. So being a new element added to the premise that has since become part of canon, but was first tossed in here rather haphazardly, but they stuck with it.
Yeah. And I mean, they were trying to reinvent. They were trying to do things. And I mean, I give them a lot of credit for trying to remain true to the history that this show had, because I mean, they're on a new continent, a new format, all this stuff. They had every right to just completely scrap and build from the ground up. But they tried to remain as true as they possibly could to the story that had come before. So it's a rough thing to do when you are changing so much, but trying to include. So, I mean, I understand them throwing stuff like that in there, just the stuff that had been name checked. They're like, hey, we can use that. This hasn't been used before. We can throw it in here and it's not going to mess with the consistency that has been, you know, previously established.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. And in retrospect, a lot of the current production teams, and even under RTD, they look back at some of the aspects of what they ended up putting into the broadcast itself, and they have a kind of a love-hate relationship as well. I mean, they understand a lot of the choices that were made in terms of, like, you know, casting Eric Roberts and so forth, and, which are things that a lot of us just, you know, we grit our teeth. But they were looking at it as, well, you had to have an established American actor, you were in a San Francisco backdrop, so you needed to have, you know, something to kind of sell that, but maybe it didn't have enough Britishness to it. I don't know. But looking at specifically at what McGann was able to do, especially when he starts to get his footing, you know, the memory starts to come back to him, he starts to get a little bit more confident about who he is. He doesn't have complete control of everything, but as he's gaining those little toeholds on things, his charm level starts to increase, and he just becomes, along with his confidence, comes this endearing nature that even, like RTD said afterwards, you know, he's like, Eighth had to go through all of these things in a little over an hour.
Yeah.
So, and McGann does that. He goes through all of these turns and hits all of these facets from the passionate hero and these little moments of comedy, like the cop and the jelly baby, you know?
Yeah.
But, and I think RTD was quoted, he's like, you see literally every facet the man could have brought to it, and he conquers every single one himself. And it's interesting the way he phrases that. He's like, you know, the show didn't do it, but he personally was able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he concludes by saying, it's just a real shame that we didn't end up seeing more of that. Now, that was a statement from back in 2009. So, thankfully, we've now had the opportunity to get much more of McGann's Eighth. And we've been able to see how much more he could have put into the role in a televised opportunity. I don't know if we'll ever get any more of that, though, beyond Well, night of.
Yeah, we can always hope.
Yeah, well, you know, they all, as always, they always leave the door open.
Yeah. So, but, I mean, we do get plenty of other Eighth Doctor stories, though, and some of them are absolutely brilliant. Yeah, so, I mean, honestly, I think you'd be hard-pressed to pick an Eighth Doctor story, at least the audio dramas and stuff, that you don't thoroughly enjoy, at least, at the very minimum, Paul McGann's performance.
Mm-hmm. He gets so much out of the role in terms of, he reminds me in a great deal of, if you were to take some sort of a blend of the charm of Peter Davison and the, at times, the sort of the boyishness of Matt Smith. But yeah. But aside from the two of them, there seems to be a little bit more of a, I don't want to say maturity. Maturity isn't the right word, but there's sort of a centering, a sense of purpose that he ends up putting into it. And especially in some of the audio plays that we chose to talk about tonight, that I think really carries across something that I think that he is very unique in terms of what he's done with the role.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So that the first one that we're looking at is Lucy Miller. And this one is actually really interesting because we see the return of Susan.
Correct. Yeah, we get an opportunity to be able to return with Susan. And not only talking to Susan, we knew from some of the stories that Susan had gone off and decided that she wanted to live a normal life. She wanted to marry human and try to live some sort of life of normalcy. Completely impossible for anyone who's going to be that intrinsically attached to the Doctor. But then we also get an opportunity to hear more from Alex, who is her son. So now we have the great-grandson of the Doctor. And it's funny because they keep kind of bouncing back and forth between calling him Granddad and the Doctor. It gets a little confusing at times. But now, just bear in mind, you're always, because this is kind of a two-parter, there's no official name for the pair of the stories, but you've got Lucy Miller, which is, you know, titled after the companion who has been running with the Doctor now for three, well, I don't know how much actual time has passed, but 3 years of recording these audio plays that Sheridan Smith as Lucy Miller and Paul McGann had been doing these Big Finish productions together. And Lucy reminds me quite a bit of Rose. She's like this 19-year-old, just really brassy and able to kind of roll with anything that that the Doctor throws at her. We come to find out through some of their relationships that she was prepped to be able to handle these sort of things. But this is between this and the next episode, which is called To the Death. This is where we see Lucy off. And I believe it's the last time we actually have any reference to Susan, now Susan Campbell instead of Susan Foreman.
Mm-hmm.
What was your, Haley, did you get a chance to really listen these through?
Yeah, I only got to listen to them once. I would have liked to hear them again, but okay. I was, the whole time I was listening, I was like, oh, this would be a really good episode. I wish I could see it.
Yeah, that's what kills me about more and more. And they did waves and waves, four series of what they refer to as the Eighth Doctor Adventures. And then they started doing the Dark Eyes series, which is another thing that we're going to be talking about tonight. But every single one I listen to, I could easily see this televised. In fact, I'd really love to see this televised. Not just because of the quality of the voice work, but the scripts are such compelling ones. I mean, we've got mention of the monk here. You know, we talk about, you know, every once in a while we come across one of these Time Lords who's just a right bastard for whatever reason. Well, the monk is a self-serving prick, essentially, who's out there, who's basically, he's... The Earth is meeting its demise because they've been exposed to a plague that's killing off the human race. So the monk, in his philanthropic means, is going around collecting all of these wonders of art and jewels and things to help remember the humans by. So that the universe will never forget the beauty that the human race was capable of creating. Yeah, okay.
Because
yeah,
that's the kind of help that I want from a Time Lord.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, you know what? Just write my name down. Remember who I was. That's good for me. You know, have a nice one. I'm going to go get shot now.
Yeah. But the monk is just this perfectly oily, sleazeball character that you just love to hate through the whole thing. Just really well portrayed and really well executed. And it's just kind of entertaining. Every once in a while you get one of those villains who you love to listen to because you just, you know, it's entertaining in how much you hate them. So, yeah, the monk is definitely one of those.
Yeah.
But then on the flip side of it, because this is a great Dalek story, you've got the idea of this Dalek time controller. And I wanted to bounce this off of either of you in terms of, I was drawing a lot of parallels, but actually some things I liked better about the Dalek time controller as this sort of mastermind manipulator behind some of the strategies and things that they do compared to Davros. Well, I mean, just in terms of, Davros is always the one, you know, he's always been saddled with being the creator and always wants to be recognized as such, whereas the Dalek time controller is... You know, is just like any other Dalek, you know, as far as the, you know, the physiology of it or anything, but it's responsible for assisting strategies and tactics for the Daleks long game. So it's rather than just trying to come up with the attack of the moment, mm-hmm. it's something where it's, you know, it's a plan that's set in motion centuries before it's executed. Or in this case, it's a matter of, you know, manipulating a very self-serving Time Lord, the monk, to get his assistance in setting something up that won't pay off for, you know, a generation or two. And it's just, and obviously it's got all of its repercussions, but in communicating or any of the conversations between the Doctor and this Dalek time controller, it feels very Davros-like because they sit there and play that chess game again.
Yeah.
Kind of reminiscent in a little way, of the cyber controller that we end up getting, you know, season before last.
Yeah, Nightmare in Silver.
Exactly. And I'm wondering whether there might have been a little bit of a common thread between the development of the two.
Yeah, or just the blatant ripoff, maybe. I don't know.
I don't think Neil Gaiman would say, oh, you guys did a really great job with that audio play, but, you know, it'd be so much better if it was a Cyberman controller instead of a Dalek controller. Yeah, that's it. That's the ticket.
I'm just going to steal this bit here.
I believe the term you want to use is yoink. But yeah. And then we end obviously with, you know, this is Lucy's exit, and she goes out literally in a blaze of glory, flying a Dalek ship into with a nuclear warhead essentially strapped to the thing to take out this drill, you know, this mine that's been going down into the center of the Earth, and she's got this huge exit. You know, and it's heart-wrenching, and it bottoms out the Doctor. I mean, he literally, in like the last couple of minutes of the thing, he's absolutely torn to shreds. Mm-hmm. And he turns to the one person that he thinks that he can cling to for something to keep him out of the darkness that he knows that he could fall into at moments like this, and that would be his own granddaughter. And she says, no, I can't do this. I can't get back into this. And she leaves him to travel alone. So talk about getting an opportunity to get everything you possibly want out of McGann. He runs the gamut in this one. You know, he has kind of his funny moments in some of the earlier parts of the first episode, and because he and Lucy have this great rapport. They're like, you know, big brother, little sister, riffing off of each other. And by the time you get to the end, I mean, you've seen him absolutely shredded. Really, really great stuff. I cannot recommend enough for anybody who wants to know what McGann could have possibly put on screen or what he's capable of doing with this role. This would be the pair of episodes I would ask you to get a hold of.
Yeah, I mean, this was a great example of everything that McGann is able to bring to the character. And, I mean, you have absolutely no visuals to go off of. This is just purely, you know, voice acting. And he's just completely kills it. And, I mean, I'm hard-pressed not to claim that the Eighth Doctor is my favorite after listening to some of these things.
True. Well, it segues beautifully into what was actually followed in the production cycle for Big Finish, which was going into the Dark Eyes series, or what was actually what we now know as the first of the Dark Eyes series, because they've now, since February, they put the second out, and they're in production on the third, because it's doing so extremely well. But again, bear in mind with all this that both the previous episodes and these Dark Eyes series are both written and directed by Nicholas Briggs, who we all know, obviously, as our voice of damn near every villain.
Every creature, yeah. With the exception of Strax.
But who knows? Maybe he's actually back there too. Well, I want to step back here and kind of get both of your takes on the Dark Eye series, because it does a lot of intentional jumping around in terms of its time and location across the four episodes that make up that first little series block. But it's one of those ones where, kind of like a Tarantino thing, where you're getting snippets here and there, and they don't start to lock together until about halfway through, and then you start seeing where they overlay.
Right.
So I wanted to kind of get your feel for what you thought of, you know, Molly O'Sullivan and you know, coming into the, you know, the dark place where the Doctor was.
Haley, what'd you think?
Well, I actually listened to this one first before I listened to the other one. So I came in and he was kind of angsty over Susan and Lucy, and I didn't know why. And then Molly comes in, or Molly might have come in first, and her accent, very thick and hard to hear through on the, for at least the first chunk of the story. I struggled with that.
A country Irish girl she is.
Yeah.
But she keeps commenting on the fact, flying around in your tardy box.
Yeah, the tardy box.
Tardy box with a penny whistle.
Yes.
It just killed me. And even you got all these soldiers going, he's asking for his penny whistle again. What's he doing with it? It lights up and makes noises.
I was trying to listen to this while I had a very hectic week. So I was like, okay, I can listen to this while I'm doing stuff. And I'm listening to it and I'm like, wait, what the heck just happened? So I have to like stop and rewind it and listen to it again. And I finally got to the point where I'm like, no, I need to cut out some time and actually just sit down and do nothing but listen to this, because it takes some effort to keep up with it, because they do trust their audiences to be intelligent enough to gather what's going on. And I wasn't at the time.
And as I mentioned, they do a bit of time jumping. I mean, they go everywhere from starting out in the First World War, which is interesting, because the Doctor, when he's trying to get his bearings of where he is, he's referring to this as the First Great War.
Yeah, he's like, everyone's like, what do you mean?
Whoa, you mean there's another? And then all of a sudden you're in the 70s, mm-hmm. So there's communication with somebody where he's where they bring back Nissa's, what the hell's the name of that device? The interrogator, and he's sending the message forward, communicating through a machine that is not supposed to have a voice recognition machine in the 70s that's not supposed to have pre-recorded messages on it, and he's leaving messages. So Briggs plays around with a lot of really fun elements.
Yeah, and I mean, he does it brilliantly too. This is the kind of time travel stuff that I enjoy so much in the show, and they never do. It's stuff that you're like, wait a minute, okay, that makes sense. I can see that, and it's just, you know, you've got a time machine and you use it as a car. Like, come on, do more with it. And this really does play into that a lot and give you that, okay, if I jump forward here and then go back and do that, it's a very kind of, I hate to say this, but Bill and Ted's almost. Remember the trash can.
Well, yeah, you know, setting things up. If I put this down here, or if I remember to put this down here, it'll be there for me later. It has all those elements, but I could not agree more. This is one where a lot of the time play is the stuff where, when you get little hints of it in the episodes that we've seen televised, it's so entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder why it's not being done more often. And I think Briggs as a writer, and I'm starting to get to appreciate more of what he could do, I mean, because of obviously his tenure with the program, and he's such an enthusiast, but he's very careful about the things that he wants to toy with. The idea of, you know, Straxus and Kotris, the idea of one regeneration of a Time Lord who knows or comes to find out that his future regeneration is going to do horrible things, or I'm sorry, in reverse, a future regeneration knowing the crimes of the past is willing to go back and actually eliminate himself. You know, it's all this kind of time bending concepts that you think, God, this just makes for a really interesting story. And then it goes back to what Haley was saying at the beginning. I would love to see this televised. This would kill.
Oh yeah,
televised. Yeah.
But again, this is something that's very different than the show that we have on TV. I don't know if it would play to the typical audience. I mean, yes, for diehard Whovians, the ones that actually dig in and get the stuff, you know, for people that listen to this kind of podcast, this is brilliant. But for somebody that just sits down every now and again on Saturday and says, oh, hey, it's that Doctor show again, I mean, it would just completely destroy any preconception they had about the show.
Yeah. Well, so. Right. Well, unless this became something where, and we had toyed around with this idea before, you know, why can't you do a, you know, if everybody always contemplates spinoffs, couldn't you do a spinoff that is the alternate timeline or the missing chunk of the timeline, because that way it doesn't have to necessarily interfere with what's currently airing. You know, have we ever had something where there were two programs running that had to do with the same set of characters at two different points in their lives?
Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z, I think, aired at the same time.
Oh, okay. Huh. Yeah, I guess. And
I didn't know there was a difference.
Well, one of them's following well, them the, as the they were spelling, kids.
Jay.
Yeah, well, there's a whole letter difference there.
My bad.
No, Dragon Ball followed, like, it was like the kid adventures, and then Dragon Ball Z was when they were adults.
So, yeah, I mean, I looked at this as far as all the aspects. It was hitting so many things that I really enjoyed about, obviously, some of the televised episodes. It was also as far as a lot of the Big Finish stuff that I've heard from, whether it be from Davison or Colin Baker, or even some of the stuff that Tom Baker has been recording with them now. He was the last one to come on. This was hitting so much of it. I love the idea of Molly O'Sullivan's character. I think she's got this great combination and what she brings out of the Eighth Doctor as far as, you know, you call me Dark Eyes one more time and I'll punch you in the nose, you know, and she's got this brassiness and she's strong, but she's got a very dry delivery, but that delivery against him is funny. She's like almost the straight man character.
And you see it, like, you see their relationship kind of grow, and her constantly coming in and messing with the TARDIS, and the Doctor keeps getting frustrated with her, and at some point you recognize, like, she's doing it just to get a rise out of him. And she starts, like, laughing about it, and that starts the Doctor laughing about it, like, no, don't touch that, you know? And it's just, it becomes this game that they're playing together, and you're like, holy crap, they really are getting along together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great back and forth between them.
You know what was killing me, and I want to bounce this off of both of you, because it smacked me about, I don't know, maybe about into the second installment of this. I can't remember the name of these things. It wasn't the one called Tangled Web. It was the Fugitives. And it was exactly that point where he's starting to figure out, or he's really questioning how she knows so much, or how easy it is that she's rolling with all these things. You know, and we always remark about the fact that, you know, the mark of someone who's bound to become a companion is someone who gets exposed to all of the grandeur and says, okay, I get it. You're an alien, spaceship, all right, time travel, sure, let's go.
Yeah.
You say, okay, well, they're going to be a companion because they seem to have this, you know, under their skin. But she had this weird mystery about her, and it was smacking me of a Clara kind of thing.
Kind of, yeah. Just done really well.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like what I hoped they'd do with Clara.
Thank you.
I actually have that exact note. I really like the idea of a companion from the past instead of a contemporary.
Yeah. Okay. So it wasn't just me. All right. Because it was killing me. I'm like, this is what the Clara mystery should have.
Exactly. And that's exactly what I felt the entire time, too. It was just kind of like, okay, this, if they did this with Clara, it would be compelling enough to overlook a lot of the flaws and stuff. But it was just, they really do sell the mystery, and it's not, and it's done in a way that it's, you know, you get a little bit and you're starting to piece it together yourself, but you know that there's more to come, instead of just like, hey, mystery, no, don't look behind the curtain, mystery, okay, here's the answer.
Well, the way this one wraps up, I'm definitely not going to spoil this one, because I want people to be able to work with this. But we come to find out that obviously the Daleks have been involved with manipulating and placing, along with some rogue Time Lord involvement, in setting Molly up. She's kind of like the linchpin to this trap that they've been setting for the Doctor. But obviously we can tell that more and more of these confrontations. There have been other Eighth Doctor adventures that involve, you know, our Cybermen or these one-off kind of villains as well, but it starts ramping up more and more often that it's Doctor and the Daleks, and it's getting more and more intense as these productions go through. It feels to me a little bit like they are trying to give us the actual build-up that brings us to
the Time
where
War.
Where we see, yeah, and Night of the Doctor, specifically.
Yeah, and I definitely got that vibe where it was just like, okay, you know, at first you're kind of like, oh, hey, the Daleks again. Ooh, they're really trying to make them scary, and oh, wait, I see where this is going. Okay, this just took a serious turn.
Yeah, I mean, there's some, for anybody that's kind of concerned that the Daleks have become a little bit of a non-threatening villain, or that they're just not, you know, not creepy or anything anymore or what have you, and they just become, all right, these angry little alien tanks and such. These kind of stories show the lengths that they go to. It's not just, you know, yelling exterminate and firing on people as they roll down the line. There's strategies, and especially with this Dalek time controller and things, there are things that they execute or plans that they set in motion which are much larger scale. And I think that's what keeps them, in my opinion, as formidable and outright creepy as they always have been.
Yeah, absolutely. So what was your take on this whole thing, Haley?
I actually like the Daleks a lot better in an audio thing, an audio format, because when you look at the Daleks, you're just like, oh, it's a trash can with a plunger. But when you can't see them, they're actually kind of terrifying.
Valid point.
Yep. And knowing the fact that, and I like the fact that with this extended material, if you want to call it that, as far as everything that goes on in the additional novels and in the audio plays, and you get to see, you know, in a lot of times in the televised episodes, the Doctor says, oh, I've been battling them for centuries. I've come up against them 100 times. Okay, well, when you say that line, you think, okay, well, you've faced them hundreds of times. Well, now you get a lot of those instances. Now you're actually seeing them played out, so now you know a lot more of what our present-day Doctor, if you want to say that, is carrying on his shoulders every time now when he sees one. Because now it's like, okay, now, oh, I remember, you know, the genocide, the plagues, the this, the that, the, you know, the time manipulation, the traps that they've laid, the thousands upon millions upon billions that they've killed. Now I understand so much more, because it's not just someone saying, oh, well, you know, I fought them a bunch of times. They're right bastards, they are.
Right. Yeah, it definitely kind of justifies or helps you to understand the choice of genocide.
Oh, and the that on again off again regret for not putting the two wires together.
Yeah,
yeah. So, well, that's a nice lead into where we finally get to see Mr. McGann again, as he appears in Night of the Doctor, which is a really interesting way that they pop him up on the screen too. You know, not even just saying it's wholly unexpected, but I like the little story behind it too, even though Moffat wrote it.
Imagine that. The guy can do stuff right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the line that he gives when, you know, it's just that, I'm a doctor, but not the one you were expecting. I was like, that was brilliant.
I liked right from the get-go the fact when they start establishing, you know, the gunship in trouble and Cass, her reaction to finding out that the doctor is one of those despicable Time Lords. It says so much to know how hated they are as much as anyone else involved with this ongoing war of immense proportions, because there have got to be countless civilizations in the crossfire.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things that I enjoyed about it so much, was giving them that look into what it would be like. Because we see everything from the Doctor's point of view as far as the history goes. And it's just we get like the history lessons and this is how it happened and this is what it was. And you're like, okay, that's one point of view. So to see how it affected everyone else in a way that the Doctor really can't explain in a good enough fashion. You know, he can say it so many times, but until you actually see it like this, see someone react to, holy crap, you're a Time Lord, get the hell away from me kind of thing, you don't really understand the terror that went along with them.
Mm-hmm. It has to say something about the fact that if you were, this isn't an Axis and allies kind of confrontation.
Right.
Because there are people involved in this who do not want to have anything to do with the conflicts between these two species. But I don't know. I mean, I love seeing the fact that maybe there was something to be said about the fact that since we didn't have any of visual from Paul McGann over this long lapse, that seeing him back on screen again at that key moment, you know, where you're seeing how he has been battered and beaten and aged and weathered and worn over everything that he's been attempting to do to keep this conflict from growing as enormous as it has. I don't know. Maybe that has a kind of an impact. The fact that, you know, you finally get to see this, what was this young face in its, you know, its early 30s before, and now has become, you know, still a striking, dashing, good-looking chap, but, you know, worn.
Yeah. And that's really what it is, too, is like he looks like he has lived through the Time War. Like he has gone on into hiding, like, you know, he's like, I don't want to be here anymore. I don't want to be a part of this, so I'm going to avoid it. But it's still the stress is still, you know, playing on his face. So it is a great look into, you know, without actually having to see anything that has gone on between the movie and now, a great look into some stuff has happened. He has seen some things and he's done with it.
Right. Well, he, and maybe this is the poignant thing, he as the Doctor is done with it.
Yeah.
The Doctor cannot be any more involved with this. The Doctor cannot become intrinsically involved with the Time War. Someone needs to, but the Doctor cannot be the one to do that.
Right.
Which is what leads us to what we get.
Right. So, Haley, this was your first real introduction to the Eighth Doctor, right?
Right. This is the first thing that I saw him in.
Okay, what was your takeaway on this? I mean, I understand, like, you probably didn't get any of the references to, you know, the Sisterhood of Karn and things like that, and just any of the mythos behind it, but what was your takeaway from the episode itself?
I remember seeing it right before the 50th anniversary, and I was just really excited to see what was coming next. And it did make me interested, you know, what has this Doctor done before? What has led him to this decision?
Mm. Awesome. Yeah, and it's just... you know, we've said this. How many times have we said that, you know, if you want to write something that has emotional impact, hand it to Steamo.
Yeah.
If you want to write something that has battle sequences in it, take it far away from
it. Hand it to anyone else.
Handcuff him to the desk and leave the room. But that's exactly what this needed. This needed emotion. This was something where it was entirely about, you know, you had a total cast of what? In terms of speaking roles, three, four individuals in this little short. Mm. But all the dialogue is particularly poignant, I think.
Yeah.
You know, especially everything the Doctor utters, because this is his opportunity to really kind of explain this decision that he has to come to.
And incidentally, naming all of the companions throughout the Big Finish run, so thereby canonizing all of the companions he's had in the Big Finish audios.
Yeah, yeah. So again, just showing that the work that Big Finish is doing is recognized. You know, they are very careful about making sure that they're staying within the sandbox.
Yeah.
Unlike the, you know, the 96 movie, which kind of like let the cats come poop in the sandbox, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you really did get the feeling though with this little minisode that Steamo put a lot of thought into it. I mean, I really think that he probably had just as much time poured into this little 5 minutes of, you know, of throwaway, basically throwaway stuff that he did into the 50th. Like, he put so much thought into this because there's not a word in this script that isn't there for a damn good reason.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and you think about the ones that particularly carry, you know, the Doctor No More phrase, you know, and that no more, which we know ends up echoing out
right
for so long. And then everybody loves the little biblical reference that was thrown in there, for a physician, heal thyself. But it's, that just shows that this in particular gave me, I remember when we first got a chance to clap eyes on it, said there has been a lot of meticulous attention paid to the writing heading into the 50th. So it just, the excitement level was absolutely peaked.
Yeah.
Does this allow us to be able to back up a little bit? Because I know, Jay, we talked about when this first aired, we said, would this allow us to be able to do, you know, to back up through televising or at least webifying, you know, some of the missing pieces? I don't know necessarily we need to.
No, we don't need to. Yeah, and that's what it is. It would be a nice bonus to have, but it's not required. I mean, this really does sum up everything brilliantly in a little 5-minute package. But it's just the fact that we got to see McGann on screen again and see what he is capable of that makes us think, okay, I want more. I want to see what has led us to this point. I understand that it's implied and I don't need it, but I wants it.
Yeah. So, and all I can do at that point is just say, go ahead and start throwing some money at Big Finish so that you can at least get those stories in an audio format. And don't think that you're cheating yourself at all by listening to the audio dramas, because the production quality is astronomical. You know, in terms of their sound foleys, their scoring, the music is phenomenally done. It's just great stuff to be able to appreciate. And, you know, like any kind of story that you're going through, if you're having a certain sense taken away from you, think about when you're reading a book and you're creating the entire thing in your head. This may be giving you the audio so that you've got an opportunity to be able to sink into some of the delivery of these characters, but you can, as far as being able to picture it and carry the story through, it's great stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, like I said, it's not something that you're not going to be like, oh yeah, no, it's great. I listened to it while I was, you know, cleaning the house and whatnot. And it was entertaining. There's a lot of detail in it, and there's a lot of plot and heart poured into this stuff so that you don't feel like it was just a little like radio presentation. This is a full blown story, and you're not missing out on anything except for visuals, which you don't need because they do such a great job of it.
I would love to see Mr. Briggs be given the opportunity to write a televised episode, though.
Oh, absolutely. That would be brilliant.
Definitely.
But, yeah, that's about all that we've got for the Eighth Doctor. I mean, his run was cut way too short, and thankfully we've got a lot to fill in the gaps now, because he's just a phenomenal actor, and everything that he brings to the character is just brilliant.
Yep. Had a lot of fun I would not be ashamed at all to say that he's, you know, within my estimation, one of my top five doctors.
He's definitely in the top 12.
That's, wow. You're going on a limb on that one.
I'll give him top 10.
Okay.
No, but like I said, I mean, he's definitely,
sorry, Mr. McCoy.
He is definitely up there. He's trailing, you know, Tennant and Baker closely. So, but yeah, if you haven't had a chance to see the movie, at least watch it to see his performance, and definitely go over to the Big Finish site and check out some of the work that he's done there, because it is just absolutely great.
Yeah. Oh, if you do, I know Haley had said that she ended up actually listening to these episode pairings in reverse order. So she was learning about Lucy after Lucy was gone, and then listening to the episodes where we say goodbye to Lucy. If you want to get the complete curve, go back to Blood of the Daleks, parts 1 and 2, which were the first two episodes that they of what they call the Eighth Doctor Adventures. So you get those to meet Lucy Miller and get her established storyline. Then you've got the self-titled Lucy Miller and To the Death episodes to see her out. And then the Dark Eyes series. Be an interesting little experience for you to kind of pair those three. Or pair? Stitch. Stitch those three together.
Pair the three.
Pair the three of them. Here in the third half of the show.
And triple the quad. And, you know, it's just... yeah, it's definitely give that a shot. And then next week we're finally making it into New Who, and we're going to be taking a look at the Ninth Doctor.
Fantastic.
It's going to get
my first Doctor.
Mine as well. Well, on a technicality, I will say.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we're definitely looking forward to that. And, you know, hopefully Haley will have some more to say too. It'd be nice.
Prepare the cattle prod. The cattle prod of Rassilon.
So
is it also formidable and large?
It is, and unwieldy.
So if you have an episode that you feel needs to be included in a Ninth Doctor rewatch or just retouching, then let us know. We definitely want to know which ones are everyone's favorites. There's not a lot to choose from, but I mean, I still think that the Ninth Doctor had a great run, and he's still a fantastic character, and I love going back and revisiting some of his stuff.
Quite.
So. But we do have a little bit of news this week. The first one being that Hermione Norris has actually been cast in Series 8. We don't have a character or an episode or anything yet, but she's known from The Crimson Field, which I'm not sure what the heck that is.
It's a period piece.
Okay. Steemo actually came forward and said, you know, it's a testament to the quality of Peter Harness's intense and emotional script that we've been able to attract an actress of the brilliance of Hermione Norris. Okay.
So, well, we're going to actually in a kind of a classic Whovian nod, we're going to go back to an old location. So we're going to get the opportunity to go back to Lanzarote. Yes. I think the last time we were there.
I think it was the Fifth Doctor. I'm thinking,
yeah, 84. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Planet of Fire.
So that'll be not exactly the most remarkable classic Whovian episode, but there's going to be some significance as the, you know, when you go returning to a once used location, there's got to be some reasoning behind it. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm hoping it's more than just a tip of the hat, because we've kind of been getting a lot of that lately, and it's starting to wear a little bit thin, honestly. I'm like, I love references. Don't get me wrong. Every reference that we've got, I've been like, yeah, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, going back and looking at it, you're like, okay, but did it really add anything? Or was it just like, here, fanboys, shut up for a minute. Yeah. So I'm hoping that they take the time and actually integrate it into the plot and make it, you know, make it what it needs to be in a crucial point. We'll see. But
well, speaking about turning back, yes. Or at least looking back. This is interesting. I mean, I don't know if you want to consider it, you know, earth-shattering news, but for some of the things that we've been latching onto, this is cool stuff.
Yeah.
Obviously, plenty of extended content in novel format out there. For those of you who want to choose your favorite Doctor and go ahead, and you can grab damn near any incarnation and say, all right, I want to know more of a second Doctor adventure, some things that never got televised, and there's plenty of novels, or Eighth Doctor, or what have you. Well, just in this past year, we were introduced to, you know, our 8.5, right? We've got our War Doctor. So
Doctor X.
So you knew it was only going to be a matter of time before someone said, well, I want to know some of the things that he had to deal with in being the warrior created to actually get, you know, his sleeves rolled up and get involved in the Time War. So now we finally have a novel to do that.
Yeah, so Engines of War is going to be coming out later. I don't think it has a date yet, actually.
It's supposed to be released in the end of July.
Okay.
In the UK, anyway. So I don't know. Usually Amazon in the States, for those British publications, usually you're looking at another 4 to 6 weeks, I think.
Okay. So sometime this summer. This looks like it's going to be really cool. It's a look at the synopsis here. It says, the death of billions is as nothing to us, Doctor, if it helps defeat the Daleks. So it almost looks like the Doctor's going to be taking on both sides of it, saying, okay, no, this is not how war is going to be fought. I'm going to take the rules into my own hands.
Mm. So. But notice that one of the things that's described in the blurb here is that he is going to be leading a flotilla of battle TARDISes. Yay! Against a Dalek stronghold. So there, for those of you who are just fascinated by the idea that you could outfit your TARDIS as a battle vessel, there you go.
It's a battle TARDIS. How is that not awesome?
So much for being the universal pacifist.
Yeah, so that's, I'm excited about this one. I can't wait to see this, because the War Doctor really was a very compelling character, and they did a great job with him in the 50th anniversary, and John Hurt is just, you know, fantastic when it comes to portraying him. So the more that we can get of his backstory and stuff, I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to enjoy this.
Yeah. Hopefully this will be the start of a good run of extended material that allows us to piece together the events of the Time War itself, leading us up to where we picked up again in the Day of the Doctor.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's one thing I've always kind of said, is that the Time War would be very difficult to put on screen and do justice to, because the more that you leave something to the imagination, the better it can be. Mm. So putting it on screen is going to be difficult, but putting it in a book is a different beast. Like, I think that if you outlined the Time War in literary form, it could be fantastic.
Oh, but even then, it only has to be bits and pieces. I mean, the Time War goes on for such a long period that there, you could have grabbed any moment and said, okay, here's one particular battle, here's one particular skirmish. So
yeah, because I mean, it's, they've said it burns across the entire universe and across all of time. So there, clean slate, go for whatever you want. It doesn't matter. So,
and we'll just eat it up with a spoon.
Exactly. It's what we do. But that's all the news that we've got this week, though. So Definitely check back next week as we get into the new Who stuff with the Ninth Doctor. Definitely looking forward to getting into some of that. So, and, you know, if you have anything, if you've learned anything about the Eighth Doctor, or if you, you know, dig into it because of this, definitely let us know about that too. We want to know what people's experiences are with the Eighth Doctor, because they're, like we said, there's not a lot of content or a lot of visual content. So, you know, you kind of run out quickly, and we want to know, you know, how do you find it? What do you get into, and how did it strike you?
Yeah. Or for those of you who, if we can actually convince you to broaden your exposure through whatever format you choose, you know, whatever form, whether it's written or audio or anything, that's what, you know, give us your take on what that journey is.
Absolutely.
Love to see how people's their horizons expand.
Absolutely. So, but this has been episode 86 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, these shoes, they fit perfectly.
And this is Gary saying, yes, I do talk like a fool, but I always know what I'm talking a fool about.
And this is Haley saying, is this a kissing story?
We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail. You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also, make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.